From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. One of the movies nominated for an Oscar in the category of Best Foreign Film has just started opening in theaters around the U.S. This South African movie is called Tsotsi, which is a slang word for street thug. It's about a 19-year-old who lives in a shantytown outside Johannesburg. He carjacks a BMW, shoots the owner, and drives off to find that her baby is still in the car. On today's Fresh Air, we'll meet the director and the film star. Also, two writers profiled in a book about new journalism are back on the bestseller list, Joan Didion and the late Truman Capote. We'll talk with Mark Weingarten about his book, The Gang That Wouldn't Write Straight. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the movies nominated for an Oscar in the category of Best Foreign Film has just started opening in theaters around the U.S. It's a South African film called Tsotsi. That's a slang word for street thug. My guest Gavin Hood directed the film. He's a white South African who studied filmmaking at UCLA and then returned home and made educational dramas about HIV/AIDS for the new Department of Health. Hood also wrote the screenplay for Tsotsi, which is adapted from a novel by the acclaimed South African playwright Ethel Fugard. A little later, we'll meet the star of the film. Tsotsi is set in a shanty town on the edge of Johannesburg, where a 19-year-old, aptly nicknamed Tsotsi, lives with his gangster friends. Tsotsi is the one most lacking in compassion or empathy. In one scene, he carjacks a BMW and shoots the woman who owns it. It's not until he's driven off that he discovers her baby is still in the car. The film follows Tsotsi as he tries to care for the baby and is changed in the process. Gavin Hood, welcome to Fresh Air. I want you to describe the opening scene, the scene in the train.
The opening scene where there's a man who's somewhat brutally stabbed on a train. I think that, there's this young gang led by this young man who calls himself Tsotsi, which means thug. He doesn't even present himself with a real name. He's living behind this angry mask, and he leads this ragtag little motley crew of thieves and one of the things they do is look for vulnerable people who look like easy targets to rob. And one of the individuals that they see on the station buying something and see that he has cash is an elderly man, and he boards the train. They board the train with him. Trains are very packed, very crowded, and they've selected him. As the train moves off, there's a lot of noise in the train, and they move towards this man. They surround him. And one of the gang carries what is actually a sharpened bicycle spoke. It's quite a frightening implement I'm almost afraid to describe it, but if you stab somebody up into the heart with one of these sharpened bicycle spokes and jiggle it around, it leaves very little blood and it does a nasty job. Anyway, he sort of sees this man draw this bicycle spoke and kind of play with his tie while the gang's around him, and he obviously thinks, uh-oh, I'm in trouble. The idea with the gang, of course, is to just intimidate the individual and then pickpocket him and go through all his pockets, and he will keep dead quiet out of fear, and then the train will come to another station and they'll run. But unfortunately, in this particular case, the man, as somebody goes for his pocket, objects rather loudly, and without a moment's hesitation, the man with the spike kills him. So the movie begins with a fairly graphic and unpleasant scene, which pretty much pushes the audience away from those characters, and especially the title character of Tsotsi. Now, the idea of that is this is really a tough journey that centers on themes of redemption and forgiveness and empathy, and asks us how, to what extent can we empathize with someone who initially we are truly repulsed by. So that was the challenge of setting up the character in somewhat of an ugly way.
And this opening scene is the first of several violent scenes in which we're introduced to Tsotsi and the other thugs that are his friends. And I think you handle it really well.
Thank
cinematically.
You.
Because, I mean, sure, you're making a point with all of this, but it's shot really well. It's horrifying. And at the same time, it doesn't feel just kind of like gratuitous violence.
Well, thank you for that, because I think, one of the things about violence and most South Africans at some point have experienced violent crime. I know I've been mugged. Presley, who's going to join us later, has had his own mugged experience. My mother's been carjacked twice. The thing about this moment of violent crime is it's not sort of movie violence where there's multiple gunshots and things going on, although obviously that happens. But most crime is very sudden. A single gunshot does awful damage. It's not the moment of violence that is truly shocking. It's the aftermath. So what we try to do in the movie is I hope that we haven't indulged the violence. It happens very suddenly. It's not sort of – there's a fight scene where he beats up Boston, who's asking him too many questions and making him feel truly uncomfortable.
Boston is one of his friends.
Boston is one of his friends who after this moment on the train – is ill, because this is not something that usually the victim just keeps quiet and they get what they want, but every now and then something goes wrong. And Boston can't cope with this particular one, and he feels physically ill. He is physically ill. And the others are kind of saying, yeah, he was sick, you haven't got the stomach. But of course, they're all a bit shaken. And they're trying to hide it. They're trying to hide behind this mask of toughness back in a bar where they're sitting together trying to be tough. But Boston's not coping, and he's getting increasingly drunk, and he keeps asking Tsotsi these probing questions about, you know, Tsotsi, that's not a name. What's your real name? Every man has a name from his mother. And it keeps asking these questions until eventually Tsotsi punches him full hard in the face and beats him. Now, when we were going to do that scene, you know, just to be a little lighter for a moment, my stunt coordinator is like, okay, so we're going to get breakaway tables and we're going to go through a glass window. You know, and I'm saying, you know what? I don't want to disappoint you, but actually the one punch lands. He tries to crawl away under a table. The table is thrown towards the audience, us, the camera. We don't even see what happens behind the table. We just see a fist going up and down and four or five times. And then Tsotsi runs out of the shebeen, the illegal drinking place as it is. And we then only do we see the face of the person who's been punched. And it's in bad shape, which is, you know, a few punches heavily delivered are unpleasant. So you don't need to indulge it to say, to make your point. And the shock is how we as characters, as people, deal with the effects of violence. And that's really what the movie then becomes about, is how do you rediscover your humanity when you've been through or behaved violently or been a victim of violence?
Now, this movie is about young people who grew up in the townships, incredibly poor. Tsotsi, the main character, is basically orphaned at a pretty young age.
Yes.
And grows up on his own without any kind of attention from or comfort from parents.
Yes.
But all the crime that these, all the people that these young thugs prey on, they're black too. So it's not a South African movie which is about conflicts between black people and white people.
Right.
It's about young black people preying on other black people. And they're preying on other thugs. They're preying on other poor people. They're preying on middle class suburban people. So I'm interested in the fact that it's not a racial movie in that
well,
sense.
Well, I mean,
it's not a black-white movie.
No, and I mean, in a way, I almost wish we could say it wasn't a black-black movie either. I mean, it's just a movie about people who are black in these circumstances, and I sometimes feel, you know, at what point are we allowed to say that these people are people and these are their circumstances and not draw attention to what color people are? Because crime affects people of all color. You know, there are victims of crime who are white. There are victims of crime who are black. Poor people are victims of crime and don't have the economic resources to put up big walls often around them, and wealthier people do. And in the movie, the wealthier couple that is carjacked and who live behind walls are black. But the point really was to say, let's examine, if you like, the dynamic between the haves and the have-nots, which is more of a class issue than a race issue, although the two are often linked. They are not the same. And we have a very strong and fantastically, you know, it's wonderful that we have this very strong rising black middle class and indeed wealthy class, but we still have issues of poverty. And as President Mbeki said, you know, poverty is a huge issue that we have to deal with. He doesn't phrase that in terms of race. He phrases it as a phenomenon called poverty, which affects poor people. And increasingly, there are even, in fact, more and more poor white people because that job reservation that they had under apartheid is gone.
Now, early in this film, this young gangster carjacks a suburban woman's car,
yes,
shoots her, drives off with the car, only to find that her baby is in the car and he has to figure out what to do with the baby.
Yes.
So he accidentally has this baby now. He doesn't know how to deal with it. He diapers it in newspapers, carries it around in a shopping bag, and leaves the baby alone in his shack when he goes out. And one day he comes back home to the shack to find the baby covered in ants, as if the baby were like some rotting fruit that he'd left out that was covered in bugs.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really horrible scene, I think a very well done scene, and I'm wondering how you found a parent willing to have their baby do this performance.
Well, let's hasten to say, and I'm going to give something away on air, but I think it's important. It is a movie, and the most important thing about a movie is that you don't harm anybody or do. And so the ants in that scene are done in computer generated graphics. I mean, I almost feel bad giving that away because I hope it doesn't detract from the scene because it's an important scene. So on one hand, I wish I hadn't said that, but on the other hand, as you've asked, you know, Mom would never have allowed us to put ants on her precious child's face. And the scenes with the baby were extremely tedious, frankly, to shoot, because there are scenes in the film where the baby cries. And of course, mom, if the baby cried for more than 10, 15 seconds, wanted to pick it up out of the shot and give it a hug. And then we'd come back later and carry on. We also brought babies into the studio at the end, four or five babies with their moms, and the sound man just recorded every sound when they screamed and the nappies being changed. And we then uses these sounds for shots where the baby is off screen or whatever to help us create a performance from a 3-month-old. I spent ages next to the camera, you know, going coochie coochie coo and doing whatever I could to get reaction shots that I could then edit in to with the work that Presley Trenayachai does so beautifully, where he's essentially, we've storyboarded a scene and we know what the emotional beats are required, but you can't ask a baby to act with you. The baby does whatever it does. So you do the work on the actor and knowing what reactions you want, and then Presley goes on home and we stay and keep working with that child until we filmed enough to get the various reactions that I know I need to tick off on this board. It was a nightmare, to be honest.
Well, you have a lot, the baby's adorable and there's a lot of really cute baby stuff, but there's also some parts where the baby is terrified or just really uncomfortable or starving. So how did you get the more baby in jeopardy kind of reactions?
Well, you say we have these shots of the baby on the table when it's going to have its nappy changed and it's very traumatized. You lay it on the table, you've lined up the camera, you've lit it, you lay it on the table, and at first the baby's fine and it lies there. And you know what? After about 10, 15 seconds of lying on this hot table, it does get uncomfortable and it starts to object. It goes, and it starts to move its arm around. And then mom says, that's fine, and now the baby's gone. Well, now you got that one shot, except that you need it on that. So that scene took 2 days. And I'd like to think the baby was not traumatized. We did have twins, so they shared the load. And as I say, the rough stuff with the ants was done in computer graphic. But when you edit this all together and then you use sounds from other babies and you create this very intense moment, it looks like you've got a very traumatized child, which is the idea. And it's quite upsetting for a moment. But guys, it's a movie. We work very carefully and we have, you know, it's the same. There's a scene with a dog that is pretty unpleasant. And you have the animal anti-cruelty people on set. And actually, can I tell you quickly the story of the dog?
It's, please, you know, this is a dog who's I won't give away why it's character or anything, but it's an emotional and narrative pivot point in the movie. So this dog is kicked a couple of times, and those kicks break the dog's back, and we see the dog in pain, unable to move, and just whimpering.
Yeah, so you have to train a dog to crawl as if it has a broken back, and so you think you're really prepared, and they train 4 or 5 dogs, the trainers, and you come and see them 6 weeks later, and you've got 2 weeks to go before shooting, and all these dogs crawl very nicely for the trainer, and there's only one problem. They're all wagging their tails. They're so pleased that they're pleasing the trainers. It's a disaster, and that is why the dog in the movie is a Rottweiler that has no tail. You know? Now, I don't feel good about telling you all this. This is going to spoil the film. Oh, goodness me. This is not good, Terry. You should cut all this out. You've put me on the spot.
Well, it's going to be effective anyways. I think these are very,
forget
very
you heard all this.
Scenes. the story, Tsotsi, is adapted from an Ethel Fugard novel that was written during the apartheid era. And it takes place in the very early days of apartheid. Mm-hmm. So you've updated it. Mm-hmm. Why did you want to tell the story in contemporary South Africa and not make, you know, use the story and yet not make it an apartheid story?
Well, partly because I don't think its essence is an apartheid story. And that's not to apologize in any way for apartheid. The fact is that Fugard's work has always been profoundly focused on character, and the socioeconomic and political environment is brought to your attention because the character is fascinating and they're living in a skewed world. So the backstory of how Tsotsi becomes an orphan in the 50s in the novel is essentially because his parents are political activists. At least his father is away, presumed to be a political activist. His mother is dragged away one night by the security police. It's very traumatic for the kid. He hides in the chicken coop. His father comes home realizing that the mother has been dragged away. He's truly traumatized. The dog's barking. This brings us to the dog scene. The dog's barking like crazy. The man is not coping emotionally. He's furious at the world, and this damn dog keeps barking, and he kicks it. And the child witnesses this brutality without any understanding of its political, if you will, context. And therefore, the trauma on the individual is, again, a political system that is affecting an individual which the individual knows nothing about. And he runs and he becomes an orphan and raises himself. Now, from then on, the story is a parallel because it's really about a kid who's angry and distressed and frightened by the world, has lost his mom and dad, and has to raise himself and has lost this nurturing that he had briefly. And when he comes into contact with this baby that's 3 months old, there's some impulse to nurture, but he doesn't want to reveal that to the other tough members of his gang. So he hides the child in his shack and tries pathetically to take care of this kid, can't, and that's why he takes it to this young woman who he compels at gunpoint to breastfeed it, and so begins a slow shift to a reawakening of his humanity. Now, that story and the story in the modern context are exactly the same. So the only real issue was, well, how does he become an orphan in modern-day South Africa? Well, thankfully, we have a very healthy constitution, we have a democracy, we no longer have this rotten center, but we nevertheless still have social problems, one of which is the effect of the HIV/AIDS crisis, where we have a 25 to 30% HIV infection rate, which is a huge crisis, and we have a lot of orphans. And so we simply modified the backstory of Tsotsi to being a child who'd lost his mom to AIDS, father is not coping, boy wants to hold mom's hand, father thinks mom is sick, doesn't understand, which was true of the early 90s because I worked in HIV making educational programs for years for 3 years in my early work as a filmmaker, and tells the child to get away from the mother because he fears he's going to get sick. We now know that, of course, he wouldn't. But then the dog starts barking because the father's aggressive. The father's drinking because he's not coping with this crisis of illness, which he doesn't understand. And we're back into the same scene.
My guest is Gavin Hood. He wrote and directed the new South African film Tsotsi. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Gavin Hood, and he wrote and directed the new film Tsotsi. It's a South African film that's nominated for an Academy Award for Best Foreign Film. The story is set in a township in South Africa. Tell us where you actually set the story.
Well, we have set it in pretty much, you know, the toughest shanty town kind of neighborhood on the outskirts of Johannesburg. So one of the pressures we feel as a South African filmmakers is this definitive of every neighborhood? And no, it's not. But it is. There are significant numbers of tough shanty towns that have grown up around the city, mainly because people have come from many parts of the country in search of a better life. And so the language in the film is Tsotsi Tal, which is sort of gangster speak. And because people have come...
It's like a township dialect?
Yeah, it's almost like a patois. We have 11 official languages in South Africa. And people are coming, you know, Zulu people are coming from Zululand, and Sotho people and Tswana people. And many people come to the city. And then in these shanty towns, there are kids mixing with each other from very different languages. And I hasn't said these are not different dialects. Sometimes I think in speaking to an American audience, people sort of think, oh, there's black people and they have various accents. Actually, you have to think more in a European way of saying there are Germans and French and Italian people and they're all European. Well, we have Zulu and Xhosa and Sotho and Venda, and these are nations with their own traditions, and 6 million Zulu people and 5 million Xhosas, and people come together in these, and they really do speak different languages. And then this language, which is quite extraordinary, has evolved, which you hear some English, bits of Afrikaans, Zulu, Xhosa, Tswana, as these kids communicate. And so they might go home to mom and speak pure Zulu or pure Tswana, but out on the streets, they're all mixing together and speaking this amazing kind of dialect.
Why did you want to use this dialect? I mean, just in practical terms, no one outside of South Africa will know it, and a lot of moviegoers in South Africa won't know it.
Yeah.
And just in terms of practical movie terms, now you have a subtitled film, which will probably be a little harder to distribute. Mm-hmm. You might get fewer viewers because of that. Some people don't like subtitled films, so this has like practical repercussions. So why shoot it in this like shantytown dialect and then end up with a subtitled film?
It's a great question, Terry. Because when the film is in English, First of all, there's minimal dialogue, I hasten to say. I knew the film would be subtitled. So the dialogue, we were very strict about sticking to that script so that the dialogue, I hope, on the subtitles read really quickly. It's not like you're going, oh my goodness, I've got to keep up. I don't think the lead's character says more than two words for the first 20 minutes of the movie. Movies are wonderful places to tell stories visually. I wanted to have where there was dialogue, and there isn't a lot. I wanted to give you, the audience, the flavor of this place. And part of you getting the visual flavor because you're seeing it. But if I were to take you by the hand and lead you into the shantytown, you wouldn't hear English. So you're actually depriving your audience of part of a sensory experience, of being in a world that has an audio quality to it as well as a visual quality. And when actors in South Africa have to tell their stories in English, and it's not, for most South Africans, their first language, there's this barrier because you're having to work in another language, which means that what is essential to this film is a deeply honest emotional power. And Presley is so effective in his own language, and there's no barrier to him finding that emotion. Which there might be more so if he was working in English, although his English is superb, I hasten to say.
Gavin Hood wrote and directed the new film Tsotsi. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Count of Monte Cristo, introduced by Luc Sant, available in stores and online. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, with a new website at macfound.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with the director of the film Tsotsi, and we meet the star of the film. Also, we talk with Mark Weingarten about his new book about new journalism. Among the people he profiles are Joan Didion and the late Truman Capote, who are both on the current bestseller list. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Gavin Hood. He wrote and directed the new South African film Tsotsi, which is nominated for an Oscar in the category of Best Foreign Film. In a couple of minutes, we'll meet the film star, Presley Chinayache, who mostly did community theater before Hood cast him. Tsotsi is about a young street thug who lives in a shantytown outside Johannesburg. How familiar are you with the kind of shanty town that you filmed in?
Well, I mean, as you know, I'm a white African, so I did not grow up in the shanty towns. But my first work out of film school, I was hired by the Department of Health to write and direct very low budget, what we called educational dramas, principally in the early 90s or mid 90s, about HIV, AIDS, teenage prostitution, drug addiction issues, child abuse issues that the department wanted to use in schools and indeed on national television to talk about this crisis that had emerged in AIDS when the country was in complete denial about it. And it was very tough because there were certain people in the Department of Health who were committed. But most people didn't want to know because we were in the state of euphoria with a new country, with new constitution, with new democracy. How can you come with this bad news? Just go away. So it was a very strange time, but I worked in the townships and in the shanty towns and in the inner city. And it was a fantastic 3 years of my life in terms of really helping me get to know my own country in the broadest possible sense.
You shot two different endings.
Yep.
For your movie, at least two different endings. As you've said, this movie is about one person in particular who's really thuggish and brutal, who's totally lacking in empathy and compassion. And we wonder through the movie, are they capable of redemption?
Yeah.
And we'll find out at the end.
Mm.
And you shot a couple of endings. Now, usually when somebody shoots a couple of endings, I think, okay, they're going to see which one plays better in the shopping mall testing group, which ending is going to sell more tickets.
Mm.
My impression is that's not why you shot different endings.
No, we genuinely had a struggle with how to end the film, and particularly because the book ends in a certain way. And that way was appropriate because things seemed so hopeless. I've talked to Ethel about this subsequently, and things when the story was originally set in the 50s, segregation and apartheid was just getting worse and worse and worse, and so the way the book ends felt appropriate. It was deeply tragic. The end of the movie is still pretty tough, but there's a note of hope, and I'm afraid to give anything away, but what I hope it does is it's slightly more open-ended, and I hope does two things. It has a hint of hope. So this is, the movie has hope because we now do have a healthy core and a constitution from which we can build a better country. But we have to face up to the challenges such as HIV that have hit us and poverty. But also, I hope that the ending allows people to go out and talk about what they feel. I don't want the film in any way to tell anyone what to feel. At the end of the film, you are challenged to decide what you feel about this character, and you can make up, in a sense, your own ending because it has a certain open-endedness. And some people feel that he should go to jail for the rest of his life, and other people want to take him home and give him cookies and tea and adopt him. I've seen both these reactions. Probably the truth lies somewhere in the middle because he has done some pretty terrible things. But hopefully by the end of the film, you have begun to empathize with someone whose life at first appeared very different from your own, but you realize that perhaps with a different roll of the dice, this could have been your life.
Well, let me just say, my guest is Gavin Hood. He wrote and directed the new film, Tsotsi. It's a South African film that's nominated for an Academy Award for Best Foreign Film. And let me here introduce the star of the film, the actor who plays Tsotsi, a young thug living in a shanty town in South Africa. And his name is Presley Chweneyagae. And Presley, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
Tell us how you first heard that this film was being shot. How did you first learn that you could audition for the film?
It was actually when I was doing Hamlet. I was playing Hamlet at the South African State Theatre, and that's where my agent saw me. And I was still doing my matric then, so she told me to finish my schooling first, then we could talk. And after I finished my matric, which is like the last grade in high school, she gave me the script, and then I had to have a meeting with Gavin, and then, yeah, we talked about the script. And I initially had to audition for this part, Butcher, the guy with the spike, but I asked Gavin if I could audition for Tsotsi, and he gave me the chance. So, yeah, that's how I got the part.
Presley, you're playing a character in this who, for most of the movie, is really utterly lacking in empathy for anybody else. He's kind of incapable of feeling anything, and he's responsible for a lot of brutality. Did you know anybody like this? Had you been exposed to anything like this that you could draw on in your performance?
Well, yeah, definitely, because I grew up in a township myself, and I know guys like Tsotsi who really do bad things, so it was just a matter of taking all those people and making them one person, and also to draw from myself, like emotionally, go to those dark places. And you know, we've all experienced crime, like Gavin said before. And I got mugged the other time. I was from a rehearsal, and it was like 2 days before my performance. And so they hit me with the butt of a gun, and I was bleeding, and they took my bag, and they ran with it. But luckily, I had a T-shirt from a drama festival that I was in written Stop Crime, so probably they got the message.
So now I read about you that it was your mother who really encouraged you to take acting lessons, in part because she didn't want you to be exposed to a lot of crime. She didn't want you hanging out on the streets.
Well, yeah, that's true. That's true. Because, you know, like I just told you that I know guys like Zotzi. So it was part of my mom's idea to drive me out of the township, sort of. Because my school was like outside the township, and where I was attending drama classes was like out of the township too. So I'd go to school, and then after school, I run to my drama classes, and I get home around about 7 o'clock. So I don't really get to see people. And that really helped me a lot, because I think later on I started understanding that, like gaining some kind of confidence and commitment to the craft. So I must really thank her for that.
And your mother is a police inspector?
Yes, she's a police inspector, yeah.
What was it? Yeah, go ahead. And your father, too?
Yeah.
Oh, gee. So what was it like growing up with a lot of kids who were potential criminals and having parents who were police?
Well, it was a bit crazy, because my mom would tell me about, like, maybe if she was in a crime scene and she'd say to me, someone was busy saying, Presley's mom, please, please, please don't arrest me, you know, things like that. And you ask yourself, who's that guy, you know? So it was a bit crazy, but I didn't really entertain that side of crime.
In your performance in Zotzi, you're not a very verbal character in this. You have a very hardened expression on your face during most of the film. And You're obviously not letting anything in. You're not letting any emotions in, and you're trying to project toughness onto other people. I mean, your job, in part, is to intimidate other people. So, can you talk a little bit about getting that kind of tough exterior, that kind of hostility on your face, and that kind of impenetrable quality, and using that without having a lot of dialogue to define your character?
Well, one of the things that drew me to love this character so much is, you know, I think us as actors, it's always important to look at the character arc, because I think as an actor, one must change, sort of. So when we were working with Gavin, he really helped me a lot to because we worked from a basic point of generating from the inside, and then emotions could leak out after that. So I can't really explain it, but I really had to go to dark places. I remember I was so mean, because the character is so, like, he's isolated, sort of. He doesn't really want to talk to people, and he's really mean. So I kind of, like, behaved the character for me to believe in what I was doing. And again, you know, like, I can't be all lovey-dovey when I'm supposed to play this guy. So I was detached to a whole lot of people in terms of family-wise and my girlfriend and all that. But they kind of like understood that I was working. And I remember I was so mean that Gavin sometimes had to force me to say thank you to some of the runners. And, you know, it's a bit crazy.
Gavin, what's your reaction to that?
Well, I mean, you know, Presley is in a way, the most extraordinary method actor and almost self-trained. And my job was just to help him transition from being a superb theatre actor, where the work is about the lines. But he has this extraordinary emotional depth, as I think you can hear, and an extraordinarily incisive intelligence. And it was just, when we were on film, just perhaps helping him to trust his stillness and just allowing that inner emotion to be generated, and we generate it together, and there, it's too beyond the scope of this to sort of talk about how we do that. But you generate that emotion so that, as Presley said, you want more going on the inside than you allow to leak out on the outside. Bad actors emote. Good actors generate the emotion and then try to hold it back. And then when it explodes, it comes from a very deep place. And that's what Presley's talent is. He has this amazing ability to do that. But he also sometimes, I got worried at some points, because he works so deeply And he didn't want to talk to anybody on the crew. And every now and then, someone would bring him something. He didn't say thank you. He'd say, hey, it's okay to just say thanks, you know, mate. You're upsetting some of these guys. But he didn't mean it. And I shouldn't even really have said that, because his work, I mean, the crew thought he was unbelievable, because he was. And I never had to wait for one second for him. He would sit quietly if the scene wasn't happening. Other actors go off and they have a jolly old time and they're playing a game of cards. Then you have to spend time getting them back into the scene. Not so with Presley.
Presley, a couple of questions for you. Is this your first movie?
Yes, this is my first feature film.
What was it like for you to see yourself?
It was very difficult at first, because I remember they played some clips at the rap party, and I couldn't really look at the movie because I was feeling like that all over again, so I walked out. But I think it takes time. Like, after a while, you get used to it, because it takes time.
You walked out of your own movie, huh? Let's hope a lot of other people don't do that.
No. I don't think they will.
What was it like to go from stage, and particularly from a really big performance like doing Hamlet, to kind of dialing back the emotion for the character that you had to play on screen in Sotsi?
Yes, it was a bit different because it was my first film, and I think it was just a matter of adjusting, because stage, everything is a bit big. And on screen, you can't lie, and everything has to be clean and subtle. And I think Gavin really helped me a lot in doing that. And I mean, even like the first week, you know, getting to my marks and whatever was a bit of a problem, because I didn't really know about stuff like that. But, you know, the crew and Gavin and the cast, almost everybody knew that it was my first film, and they were very supportive. So that's how it worked out.
Has your mother seen the movie?
Well, yes, she saw the movie, and she was crying. She was crying. She was very happy, because she's never missed any of my shows, and she said to me that she's seen all my plays, but this was the best that I've ever done.
I want to congratulate you both on the nomination of Tsotsi for an Academy Award for Best Foreign Film.
Thank you, too.
And I wish you good luck with it, and yeah. I thank you both for talking with us.
Thanks very much for having us on the
thank
show.
Thank you.
Gavin Hood wrote and directed the new South African film Tsotsi. Presley Tweneyagae stars in the film. It's just started to open in theaters around the U.S. Coming up, Truman Capote, Joan Didion, and the new journalism of the 60s and 70s. This is Fresh Air. Two of the writers profiled in a book about the new journalism of the 60s and 70s are back on the bestseller list. The success of the film Capote turned Truman Capote's 1966 book In Cold Blood back into a bestseller. Joan Didion's bestselling memoir, The Year of Magical Thinking, won a 2005 National Book Award. My guest Mark Weingarten is the author of the new book The Gang That Wouldn't Write Straight, Wolf, Thompson, Didion, and the New Journalism Revolution. Weingarten describes the writers he focuses on as journalists who began thinking like novelists, not in the sense of fictionalizing their reporting, but in developing a novelist's sense of character and drama. I ask Weingarten where he thinks Truman Capote's In Cold Blood fits into the new journalism.
I see it as an absolute seismic shock in the way that people approach nonfiction writing. Capote was so meticulous in researching this story of the murder of the Clutter families in Kansas, spending 6 years delving into the murders, the minds of the two murderers themselves, the family, the town in which the murders took place, etc. He also, frankly, took a lot of creative license in his work, using interior monologues and sort of delving into the heads of his characters, which was criticized by his editor at The New Yorker, William Shawn, who was really ambivalent about even publishing the piece. because he felt that it was too fabulous, that Capote had really tinkered too much with nonfiction. But in my opinion, it's an absolute masterpiece and sort of a, I would say it's sort of a precursor to a lot of the procedural fiction that we read now. But I just think it's a brilliantly written book. And it, and a lot of these writers read that book and absorbed that book and learned a lot of lessons from it.
It was interesting. You say that William Shawn, the editor at The New Yorker when In Cold Blood was published, had serious reservations about even publishing it. In the movie Capote, William Shawn is portrayed as saying to Truman Capote, I'm going to make you a star. And Shawn travels with Capote and answers Capote's phone in the hotel room when Capote's not feeling up to it himself. Is that a misportrayal?
Correct. I love that film, but that was the one thing I took issue with, because having talked to Lillian Ross about this issue, Lillian Ross being a longtime staff writer at The New Yorker, as well as William Shawn's lover for many years, she told me that, yes, Shawn really didn't like the piece. He was very uncomfortable with Capote taking so much creative license. I mean, The New Yorker was such a stickler for facts, with one of the most buttoned-down fact-checking departments. And Shawn just thought that it wasn't appropriate for the magazine. So there was a struggle there before it was published. And in the film, yeah, Shawn is really portrayed as a champion of the piece. But to my understanding, that wasn't the case.
You talk about how when Truman Capote first went to Kansas to research the murder story that In Cold Blood is about, he really stood out. What stood out about him?
He was gay. I mean, that's the short answer. Here was this gay Southerner turned New Yorker, very flamboyant, I think even more flamboyantly dressed than he's portrayed by Philip Seymour Hoffman in the film, with that voice and that manner. And people were really turned off by him. People didn't really know who he was, even though he had already published Breakfast at Tiffany's and other books. And it took Capote's skill as an interviewer, as well as his companion, Harper Lee, who helped him out tremendously in opening up many doors to him.
Yeah, Harper Lee, his friend, is best known for writing To Kill a Mockingbird. Exactly what did she do to help Truman Capote when he was researching In Cold Blood?
Well, I think she had a lot of finesse in the way that she approached the residents of the town, particularly the women. And she was able to sort of subtly draw them out in a way that Capote initially maybe couldn't have done. So, and she was also his stenographer. Keep in mind that Capote never jotted down a single note or used a tape recorder when he interviewed all these people in Kansas. And it was up to... And now he claims that he had
a photographic memory.
Photographic memory, correct. But in fact, she was dutifully scribbling away many times.
Many times, but not all the time.
Many times, but not all the time, correct.
Capote described In Cold Blood as a nonfiction novel. What impact do you think the book had on nonfiction that was published after Capote's?
The way he structured the piece... The way he wrote various scenes, the way he used dialogue, it reads like a novel. So I think writers that came after Capote, now this In Cold Blood was published in the mid-60s, so he was working contemporaneously with a lot of these writers, but I think a lot of writers were influenced by this narrative skill and the way in which Capote brought a sort of rather prosaic murder story to life using his skills as a novelist. And so I think that was very influential.
I want to move on to another journalist who you write about in your book on new journalism, and that's Joan Didion. And she has a wonderful book on the bestseller list that's a memoir about a year of grieving after her husband, the writer John Gregory Dunn, died of a sudden heart attack. It's an amazing book. I mean, she seems to stand back from her own grief as she's experienced it to just kind of record it as accurately and in as much detail as she can. How would you describe her place in the new journalism?
I think her influence is twofold because she was great at two things. Early on in her career, when she was freelancing for magazines like the Saturday Evening Post, she was doing a lot of straight reporting pieces, and they were quite good. And her eye for detail was novelistic. Her ability to capture the essence of her characters with a few deft strokes was uncanny. And she was a very good reporter, and she did these pieces. Now, the other thing she did, of course, were these personal essays, which are very sort of self-searching, extremely sensitive essays about her life and her psyche. And those arguably were even more influential, not in terms of new journalism, just in terms of people writing about themselves, the personal essay form. But she does have this ability to examine herself and her emotional makeup in a way that I don't think any other writer even does.
My guest is Mark Weingarten, author of the new book, The Gang That Wouldn't Write Straight. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mark Weingarten, author of the new book, The Gang That Wouldn't Write Straight, Wolf, Thompson, Didion, and the New Journalism Revolution. What are some of the ways that you think the new journalism, the novelistic approach to writing about actual events, affected newspapers and magazines and continues to affect what we're reading today in newspapers and magazines?
It might have had a pernicious influence, I'm afraid, because Hunter Thompson, who was writing for Rolling Stone in the 70s, became such a rock star by placing himself in his own stories. And this led to a lot of really bad Hunter imitations. And when people thrust themselves into their own nonfiction narratives. And so, you know, there's been a lot of bad first-person writing that has been done in the wake of Hunter's stuff. But newspapers, I don't see it too much. I see it more in magazines like The Believer. Are you familiar with mm-hmm. Dave Eggers? Yeah. I think they do some really amazing narrative nonfiction pieces that are definitely new journalism-esque. And I still think The New Yorker does some great work like that, ironically enough, because at the start of my book, there is a story about Tom Wolfe basically attacking The New Yorker for being a horrible has-been magazine in 1965, sort of positioning himself and the fellow new journalists in opposition to what The New Yorker was all about. But of course, The New Yorker still continues to put out great stuff. But I guess you might see it more on the web. Although I'm not so impressed with what I read on the web, particularly the blogs, which I think are too hastily written. I think journalists need editors to really do the job right.
I read a lot of nonfiction books, in part because I host this program.
And right.
One of the things I sometimes have a problem with in a lot of nonfiction books now is the amount of dialogue. Dialogue in scenes where I know the writer wasn't there, and the writer often says in the introduction that this is dialogue that was reported to him, you know, by the interviewees who said, here's what I said and here's what was said to me. But it often, not always, but it often reads like a kind of fake recreation of something. And it sometimes makes me a little distrustful, because I figure, well, you can't really say word for word in quotes what somebody said 20 years ago in this room right. that you weren't in. Do you think that that's something that's happening a lot more since the new journalism
yes.
era?
Yes, no question. I mean, it was definitely endemic to new journalists, particularly people like Jimmy Breslin, who used a lot of made-up dialogue with impunity. But I think that writers do it out of fear more than anything else. I don't think they're trying to pull the wool over anyone's eyes. I think they're afraid that their story is going to be dull mm-hmm. if they don't use dialogue. And so they resort to inserting, you know, I don't think it's a hoax they're perpetrating. I just think they're afraid that people are going to turn off. Yeah, I think that's definitely a legacy of these guys that I write about in my book. But I think one can be judicious about it. And if one doesn't get too fanciful, I think it's okay. But if it's a situation where you're really heavily using so much dialogue that you didn't hear, that it just becomes absurd, well, then that's just no good.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Mark Weingarten is the author of the new book, The Gang That Wouldn't Write Straight. Fresh Air's executive producer is Jenny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Today we welcome our new associate producer, Jonathan Menjivar, who moved to Philadelphia from Chicago to be with us. We're grateful to have him here.
Support for NPR comes from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Borrowed Time, a novel of psychological suspense set in Britain by Robert Goddard. From GM, with 1.5 million flex fuel vehicles on the road that run on gasoline or E85 ethanol. Details at livegreengoyellow.com. And from the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Jean Dumestray, one of the founders of Tipitinas, a club that became one of New Orleans' musical landmarks. She's now a nurse in New Orleans, working with people who have HIV/AIDS but don't have health insurance. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air. Tipitina, tra-la-la. Oh!